If you want to bring your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. Gizmo Sapiens.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 168, which we're going to call First Contact Part 2, since we're going to continue what we were talking about last time. Even though this episode is now later than the week of First Contact. But we didn't touch on one key Star Trek property that they discussed on First Contact Day, and I do want to discuss... I guess we touched on it briefly, but I wanted to talk about it a little bit more. And then I wanted to talk about some other things that were related. And follow up on some things we kind of pushed aside because we didn't want to make that episode so long. So let's talk about Prodigy. In one way, of all of the new Star Trek properties they're doing, it's the least interested one I'm in. It is kid related.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. This is a Nickelodeon product and not a Paramount Plus product, right? Is that the one that I'm thinking of?
Correct. But it is, I mean, CBS Paramount owns Nickelodeon. So, yes, right. This is, I'm not entirely sure. More than likely, it will also be on Paramount Plus. Because, I mean, the whole back catalog of Nickelodeon is on Paramount Plus. I mean, that's part of why they expanded it from just CBS All Access. Once they reunited Paramount and Viacom. Or Paramount and CBS and as a single entity. But I think it's interesting because this is really, you know, Lower Decks is a cartoon, but it's geared and its humor and everything is geared towards adults. You know, it's kind of the same thing as Bob's Burgers and Family Guy and that type of route. This is actually kind of harkens back to the 1976 Star Trek show, which, you know, was the reason they had all the Mego figures and the Enterprise, the beginning of the toy tie-in for cartoons that continued throughout the 80s and early 90s. But this is the first time since then that they've done a show that's directed really towards kids. And what gives me pause about it is the premise of the show is that there's a derelict Starfleet training vessel. No idea what happened to the crew or anything. That is found by a bunch of aliens. And they did on Paramount Plus Day on First Contact Day, they in their little show that they did talking about this, that it does happen in the Delta Quadrant. So, you know, there's that tie-in with Voyager. And the only Starfleet character in the whole show is a hologram of Captain Janeway, and she's a command training hologram. And so, you know, it's in the Star Trek universe, but it's not necessarily a Star Trek show, I want to say.
Well, you know, I'm not overly opposed to that because, you know, they've been talking for years like they wanted to do a Klingon show and then never have the balls to actually do it. But to me, that would be in the Star Trek universe, but not a Star Trek show.
Yes, and I agree, and I've always thought it would have been cool because back in the FASA game, you know, when we played the FASA role-playing game, the Star Trek role-playing game by FASA, one of my favorite supplements was the free traders and all of that idea because you're not necessarily bound by Starfleet rules, but Federation law and Klingon law and Romulan law, depending on where you were at. But then there was the whole idea of the black market and the Orions and the Ferengi and, you know. So, to me, a show like that has some appeal. And this has veins of that. If, you know, these teenage aliens find a derelict Starfleet vessel and they learn about it and supposedly fly it around and get into mischief and all kinds of things. It could be entertaining. But the problem that with shows where, particularly with kids, is the characters have to be something that the kids really identify with. Because the visual part is just as much as important as the morality, the soul of the character, you know, all the other things that make up the rest of the character. And without humanoids, because, you know, if you go back and you look at a lot of these cartoons that existed, the ones who did not fare so well were the ones that kids had a hard time identifying with. You know, that's why there's only like one season of Monchi Chi's and there's one season although that was more of an adult thing, the whole My Little Pony thing. But you know what I'm saying. You have to have some strong characters that they identify with, and then also, even if they are aliens, that would be easy for these, you know, kids to dress up and, you know, to play. So, and looking at the picture, some of the aliens are very alien, which I like, you know. That's what was always my complaint about Star Trek. You know, the original Trek. And, you know, if you look at TOS at the time, they're using practical effects. There was no digital effects. And so you're limited on how you can portray aliens. So most aliens were humanoid, you know. And then what was great is that they created the Hodgkin's Law of Interplanetary Development, which they even mention in Mary's World. The episode Mary's World in TOS that talks about, you know, similar planets will develop similar life forms and things like that. And that's what, you know, so they could explain why there were so many humanoids. And then you also had the Preserver line where they scattered humans across the universe. So they knew that that was an issue and they tried their best. Look at the episode, I forget the name of it, with the Horda.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of people had a hard time understanding that episode until later, because the alien intelligence you were dealing with was not humanoid, you know? And even in Next Gen and stuff, they kept that humanoid thing going on. Now, we're starting to see that differ quite a bit, mainly because, like, as digital effects and CGI got better and better and better up to now, they, you know, practical effects aren't really being done. So now you can do all these kind of weird things and, you know, represent aliens in other ways digitally, you know, to make people think. Because, you know, that's also popular science fiction, because that was kind of the mindset. A lot of it was that way.
And again, I think that leads us back to Babylon 5. With the shadows,
yes,
being the first real CG race to get any kind of major screen time,
yes,
I think Species was a 4192, or is that Pete Rose's hit number?
Yeah,
I don't know. The Borg Killers. You know, that was really the first Trek race that got major screen time.
And look how much farther after like Next Gen that was. That yeah. was, you know, towards the near the end,
near
like
the
season
end of Voyager,
five of Voyager.
Yeah.
So
very significant amount of time.
Yes. Absolutely. And you know, that's kind of an interesting thought as we move forward. And speaking of practical effects, so Paramount just invested millions of dollars in this. Let me see if I can find the article. It's interesting. So that basically it is CGI, but done in such a way that it is a practical. It's done like they used to do the practical effects. So like in TOS, when you saw the backgrounds, you know, in like when they were on planets and you'd see a cityscape in the background, that was a static painting.
Correct.
That somebody had painted.
Yes.
And now, because there are some downsides to CG effects. Green screen technology, no matter how good it is and how well it's edited post-production, still there's artifacting, and it's never exactly perfect. It you know, for motion pictures, so television and movies, unless you're going frame by frame, you don't typically pick up on that. But they've created, and they're not the only ones who've done it, so I think Disney is doing it now, but Paramount is the first. They created a soundstage that has a CGI digital background that they can project whatever background they want, and it's already been used in this next season of Discovery.
Mandalorian was the first show that I'm aware of that used it.
Yeah, but that extensively. That was on a smaller scale. Evidently, they're now building. Paramount has built a giant soundstage so that they can build. So essentially, they can build practical sets in front of it and then use it to project a dynamic background.
Okay.
But since the actors and the practical sets are, or the main features of the practical sets are in front of it, it looks like it has depth, and there's none of these issues with green screen artifacting or blue screen artifacting and all of that. And it also makes production much faster, because now that we're not doing a CGI effect and having to do all this post-process editing to make sure it's believable, it's kind of a throwback to TOS days, but using modern technology. And I guess Disney, yeah, The Mandalorian, you're right, I think did use it first. But it was kind of...
Although, I take that back. That was tech that came from Jungle Book, which he worked on, too. The live-action Jungle Book.
Yeah. Let me see this. Sorry, I was looking at the wrong end of my notes.
John Favreau is the name I was trying to come up with.
Yeah, I don't see it in my notes, but I thought it was interesting that they were using modern technology to go back and do something that, you know, so that they could use, essentially do more practical effects, which practical effects, if done right, are always more
believable
than CGI, because even, you know, my son is a digital design major, and although a lot of that is graphics arts, he does a lot of digital effects and uses Blender and all this other stuff. And we'll be watching the movie, he goes, "Oh, that's CGI." And you'll be like, "What?" He goes, "Yeah, you can tell because of this and over here. And, you know, look at the corner of the screen. It's out of focus when it shouldn't be because the camera's not using bokeh, you know." And, you know, he's one of those who will dissect all of the digital effects in a movie and tell you, "Oh, this isn't believable because of this," or my favorite is when he goes through the MCU movies and he goes, "That was horribly done." but I think it's really cool that they're going back to that. Well, not that they've gone back to that.
Yeah.
And I guess in the trailer for Discovery Season 4, where the Chancellor or President of Navarre is giving Book a mind meld, that background behind them is actually that screen or that digital dynamic background. So I thought that was very, very cool.
The more believable it gets, the better, I think. I remember seeing Mandalorian actors raving about how real their sets were.
Well, I mean, it has to help because with the performance, of that. Too, yeah. Because now you're in this, it's believable.
You're truly in the environment. Correct. Now, whereas before you were being told, "Oh, make believe this, and here's this green screen.
Here's an artist's conception of what's going to be behind you, so react appropriately."
Yeah. You know?
Yes, I agree with that. So let's move on to another little Star Trek thing that actually came up between last week and this week. They gave us a date for the next Star Trek movie, which I about fell out of my chair on.
I find this very hard to believe.
Well, I mean, it did come from Paramount, but you know, it's been 5 years since Star Trek Beyond, and then we're 2 years away from the next one, so that's a 7 year gap from a movie perspective,
which is kind of unprecedented, really.
Correct. And so they're saying June 9th, 2023.
Are they planning on releasing this in theaters?
I have no idea.
Because I don't think theaters are going to be there.
Yeah. Well, I don't think the distribution via theater is going to be nearly as big. I mean, this is the type of movie, you know, Star Wars, Star Trek, big science fiction, big war battle, big... Those are the types of things that I think movie theaters lean towards, you know... You go and see some, sit in the second row or first row and watch some epic, you know, war scene or space battle or something like that. And, you know, that's what movie theaters were made for.
Yeah, no, I get it. What I'm saying, though, is they're not going to be there.
A lot of them are not going to be there. You're right.
I don't understand why Paramount would make that gamble.
Well, and they may not. I mean, they may release it in movie theaters along with the simultaneous release with... You know, on Paramount Plus. I mean, look how vastly successful all the movies, even movies that Warner Brothers knew were not going to be great box office movies, like Tom and Jerry.
Uh-huh.
How successful they become because they're releasing them on the same day and only for 30 days. You only get to watch them for 30 days on HBO Max. You know? And Disney's trying to milk it. You know, they're trying to do the same thing, but they want to do it where... You have to pay extra money to see it. And while I can kind of understand their argument that to pay $18 to see a movie that would have cost you $18 to go see in person, yet you get to see it, you know, multiple times and everything else, but nothing they've brought out has been compelling to watch. I mean, Mulan was horrible. You know, and Apple did the same thing with the Trolls World Tour during lockdown. But that movie would never have brought a big box office draw because that's a kid's movie. You know, but Wonder Woman 1984 did a good thing, good job. And look how many people watched the the Snyder Cut of Justice League. You know? And you could not have sat through that in the movie theater. It was over 4 hours long. Yeah. You know, I watched it. I started it one night, watched like an hour and a half, and then the next day I watched like another hour, and then the next day after that I finished it. You know? And to some respect, that's the type of medium we need for filmmakers who want to make a much longer story. You know?
Yeah.
Because the one thing I didn't feel... I did feel that you could have... broken up the Justice League movie into like three or four movies.
Right.
But I didn't feel like just because it was 4.5 hours and the fact that I could pause it and, you know, come back to it, I didn't feel like it was, completely disjointed and, you know, it flowed. And it wasn't hard to pick the movie back up from where I paused it, you know.
My thing with that is, and if you wanted to sit through it for 4 hours straight, you could.
Yes. And I had several friends who did. I mean, don't get me wrong.
Which is, to me, like, take Infinity War and Endgame.
And put them together as
a If you could have put them together and made a 3.5 hour movie out of that, I'd have sat for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wouldn't have bought my popcorn and pop to go with it at the theater, but I'd have sat for that.
Yeah. Well, and there is precedent for that. I mean, Dances with Wolves had an intermission. It was that long. Wasn't Silence of the Lambs, I believe they had an intermission in it.
2001 had an intermission in
it. Yeah. I mean, well, and the older you go, they used to have intermissions in the movies all the time because they were all 2.5 hours, you know, 2.5, 3 hours. So, you know, I could see it happening.
JFK had an intermission.
I never watched that movie.
I mean, really, anything over 3 hours has got to have an intermission in it.
Yeah, pretty much. So, going back to the next Star Trek movie, which I find kind of laughable. Because, now, here's the weird thing about it. So, they announced a date. They did not announce a cast. They did not announce who was writing it. They did not announce who was producing it. So there,
there's no movie. There's just a date.
Yeah. So, well, there is a supposition that there is stuff there. And, you know, Paramount has, particularly towards Star Trek, after all the issues with Brian Fuller and the whole first season of Discovery and going through three different showrunners and, you know, until they settled on Alex Kirkman and Akiva Goldsman Smith and, you know, the current team who run Star Trek today. I think they're leery of talking, you know, specifics, and they're going to dole that out. One, as crumbs to keep people interested, which is infuriating.
This to me is an insult because you've not managed the project.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can't manage the project, don't do it.
So, I mean, just in the last year, they have, there's been talk of several different options for Trek films. Let's cover those. So there was, we're going to bring back Chris Hemsworth along with Chris Pine-led cast. That was one.
Yes, I remember that one.
Because there was the whole George Kirk story. And then there was the Quentin Tarantino written one.
Ugh.
And then there was the one by Noah Hawley.
Correct.
Those, at the moment, are all considered dead-end projects. So the current thought of or rumor of what's going is that Kalinda Vasquez, who wrote, she's been a producer and writer on Star Trek Discovery, is writing the film.
Okay.
With J.J. Abrams set to produce, which is a mistake.
Yes.
A horrible, horrible mistake. But I guess IO9, somebody who's part of the project and knows people in IO, a source on for IO9, said that this June 9th, 2023 release is not the Vasquez script, but a separate J.J. Abrams produced Trek film. And other than that, there is no idea if it's going to be told in the Kelvin timeline. Although, even on First Contact Day, there was talk that they're going to collapse Kelvin and Prime timelines, or at least.
How do you do that without William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, and the rest of the old crew? I don't know how you do that.
I don't know that they're going to collapse it in as collapse it like it. What I think is that they may have more crossovers, kind of like the Mirror Universe, you know? Who knows?
Okay. That's frightening.
But 7 years after the fact, Chris Pine, particularly Chris Pine, and most of the cast are probably not available. Chris Pine signed to Warner Brothers anyway. And there's some, I know that there's some other projects that he's supposedly being cast for in there now that his role in Wonder Woman is kind of over. You know, with the original Wonder Woman and Wonder Woman 84, which, by the way, was just released this year, even though it was a year late. I believe Zachary Quinto has gone on to doing Broadway.
Yeah, but he, of that whole cast, he's probably the most likely to be able to free himself up.
Yes.
Zoe Saldana is gone.
Yes.
I mean, there's no way of getting her back.
Well, even,
John Cho. I can't imagine him.
He's been involved in television shows and everything since then. I just don't see that happening. And then, you know, the one thing that was horrible, and Carl Urban,
there's totally no way,
unavailable. That, you know, although they lost Anton Yelchin, he was missed as a character in the last Star Trek movie.
Yeah.
And I just can't see them. You know.
Well, they talked to that they were not going to recast him.
Yeah.
So. I don't know. I have a hard time. I have a hard time coming back to.
I do the Kelvin cast. And I am not opposed to having a Star Trek movie about a different crew and a different ship.
Me either. And you could even put it in the Kelvin universe if that's what floats your boat. But let's just not.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And everything that Alex Kurtzman has done, I don't want to see undone by J.J. Abrams and his idiocy.
Cast of idiots.
I never, ever want to see a J.J. Abrams movie again. Ever. If his name's on it, I will not pay for it. I will not pay to go see it. I'll wait for it to come on television 10 years later.
I would much rather J.J. go back and do what J.J. does, which is J.J. stuff.
Yeah.
You know, let J.J. screw up his own universes and leave these properties that he has no business fooling with.
I mean, his Star Wars movies suck.
Oh, they're horrible.
His Star Trek movies... I will say this. His Star Trek movies were actually better than his Star Wars movies.
But that was a low bar.
That is a low bar. Exactly. Now, what? Also, this I'm one of the articles that I read about this was on Gizmodo. I guess there is going to be a giant Star Trek convention from April 8th through 10th in Chicago called Star Trek Mission Chicago in 2022.
Yes.
And that... is probably where they're going to make all the announcements about it, because that's almost, it's 14 months away from the movie, you know, and the movie will probably be, if it's actually happening, will probably be in production then. And I'm thinking that more than likely production's going to start, if they announced a date, that's because they needed a date to tell pre-production to get their ass in gear so that production can start at the end of 2021, and then they have time to film the whole thing and then get post-production and distribution and everything set up with advertising and everything else for that June date in 2023. I mean,
which brings me back to you mentioning Paramount building this gigantic new soundstage.
Well, and that would make sense if you were doing a movie.
It does. But the problem that I have with that is that under the current COVID guidelines, how are you going to do that? How are you going to shoot on a massive soundstage like that and maintain COVID protocols?
Well, I mean, they've evidently used it for Discovery already.
Discovery is a different thing in that it's a much smaller production.
Exactly.
It's a much smaller cast. A big blockbuster movie is a whole other thing.
Yeah. It's true. That's true. So, you know, and that you know, you're right. The COVID production rules would limit a big scale movie production. But my question is this, if you don't need, one of the things that Paramount has been touting a lot, and Disney as well, with like The Mandalorian and Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and then all the Star Trek properties for Paramount, is that they're talking about, and Paramount, this is in their advertising for Paramount Plus, which is really should be called Star Trek Plus, is that they're doing movie-style production for television shows. And if you look, the Disney ones, it's easier to see, like particularly like because we've seen what the MCU movies look like, and then we look at the production like Falcon and the Winter Soldier, which I like the show. I really like the Bucky and Sam characters. And I'm liking the fact that the new Captain America is going nuts. Because that does follow the comic book and fairly well.
Yeah.
But if you look at the way it's shot, the clarity, and you probably can't see it. You watch things at like 1080p or 720p. I don't know what the projector you watch everything is.
I think it's on 1080p.
Yeah. I've been watching it in 4K. And at 4K, when I watch the MCU movies, and at 4K when I watch The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, the practical effects, the digital effects, they're all the same. It's not like you think. It's not like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., where you were like, yeah, this is in the Marvel Universe, but it's not as good a quality as the MCU movies.
Right.
When you look at Falcon and the Winter Soldier, it's as good a quality as the MCU movies. And frankly, The Mandalorian's better quality than the movies that they just released from a filming and CGI effect and everything else.
Well, that's, again, low bar.
Yeah. So, well, let's move on. Okay. I want to talk about a little more about Discovery, too. Or not Discovery. Picard.
Okay.
So, they kind of said that season two of Picard and the teaser trailer with all the Easter eggs would be about... And they said it also in their interviews with Patrick Stewart and
John DeLancey.
I don't know if it was with the John DeLancey one. I watched his whole interview. I did not watch the whole Patrick Stewart one. But that the theme of season two, or the primary story, is going to be about time travel. So Screen Rant has some people who, you know, again, they get paid to be geeky, have gone back and they've gone through and you know, looked at the season two trailer, broke it down, researched the whole canon of Star Trek, and they believe that season two of Picard is the beginning of the temporal Cold Wars.
Okay. I'm not opposed. I mean, really what that does for me is it ties Enterprise to...
Well, it ties Enterprise to Picard to
Discovery. Next Gen to Discovery. Yes. To, I mean, it is a unifying
theme
concept to bring all those shows together.
Well, and it also kind of makes sense when you think about bringing Q back, you know, with DeLancey and everything, because largely although the Q could do things that would be considered godlike in a primitive society, well, heck, it was even godlike in 23rd century Star Trek land, but a lot of what they did was revolved around time. Manipulating time travel, you know, or time space, I really should say. Like, you know, the introduction of the Borg, you know, was because Q put them in Gamma Quadrant or something like that.
Yeah, no, their fascination with history is another part of it.
Yes. I mean, if you look at
a number of the episodes would be like,
well, even you look
period pieces.
Yeah, you even look at TOS. You know, so Bread and Circuses is one of my favorites. You know, the idea that Rome didn't go away on this planet and, you know, was the dominant culture and government.
Well, and there's even talk that Trelane was actually a Q.
Yes. Well, they've talked about that ever since the beginning of Next Gen.
Right.
Because the powers that they exhibit in the shows are similar.
Very similar.
Well, and, you know, what about the one, I forget the name of the one, where Apollo is the last Greek god.
Yeah. That's another one.
That's another one, you know.
The apple?
Yeah, something like that. It's pretty bad. I'm getting old. I must admit, back in, when I was in high school, and, well, even before high school... Back when I was, like, in middle school, and I always watched the reruns of Trek, but I really got interested when I was, like, 11, 12. I could name every episode of TOS. You could tell me who the characters were in it or what the storyline was, and I go, oh, that's Charlie X, or that one's For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky. And I mean, you know, Cat's Paw, the only Halloween episode.
But it's gotten to the point where...
well, there's so many episodes of Trek when you throw in Next Gen and Deep Space Nine and Voyager and Enterprise and Discovery and Picard and Lower Decks and soon Strange New Worlds, and, you know, you can't remember it all. How many episodes were the original Trek? 66?
69,
something like that, yeah.
I think.
Yep. Because, you know, I was a freshman in high school when Next Gen started, because I was 87.
Yep.
It's So that, you know, that was a long time to remember, you know, to know all of that. But, you know, it will be interesting if they do have a temporal time warp, because obviously we know from this last season of Discovery, where they're in the 32nd century, that time travel is outlawed, because that was the worry about Discovery jumping the shark all those years, 800 years into the future. And stuff. So, you know, it's going to be interesting. Very interesting. And I also don't think that the second season AI is still not a theme that they're not going to
come back to
in some one of the tracks.
I still can't get past not resolving the Matrix monsters from season one. I mean, sending them back whence they came is not a resolution. It's still open.
Well, you know, some of that is intentional. I think some of it isn't. You know, it's a storyline that nobody... that they thought it was good enough to produce more of an episodic way, but they didn't think it would be something people would be interested in, and so they didn't pursue it. And then sometimes I think they make those choices because they want to come back to it.
Well, and if that's the case, then...
Because I believe that's really the case with the AI from season two of Discovery. And we do know, because of the short treks, that the AI, that the alien AI that became the intelligence in Discovery's own computer, exists long after Burnham. You know? And stuff. So, you know, there's a lot of things I think they leave to chance, you know, because they're like, well, we can come back to that, or we've already set the Easter egg out there to bring that back at some point or another.
Plus, I do think that they are trying to set up future, and by future, I mean like 30 and 40 years down the road.
Correct. I think they are too.
Much like how we're looking at TOS for things to redevelop, I think they're doing the same thing.
I agree. So, the other thing that's kind of interesting that's going on is, I do want to go back to Orville, because we didn't really talk. We teased that last episode, but we didn't really talk about it. So, from what I've read, about half of season three of Orville was already done. Filmed, put in the can, even post-production has been done on it. And then COVID hit, and then Seth MacFarlane had other things. And I do think that past season three, Orville is probably a dead property. Because without MacFarlane, I just don't see the show being viable, you know, with Ed Mercer as the captain, or without Ed Mercer as the captain. Even though they have some good cast for the show, the show revolved around Ed Mercer. And so you would have to take the focus of the show and focus it somewhere else. And some of the characters I just don't think can be the focus of the show completely, like, the second officer. I mean, the show's been gone off so long, I can't even think of the names of anybody, but Mercer. And, you know, the other thing is, you know, in his homage to Star Trek and Star Trek The Next Gen, the end of the second season, we're in this alternate timeline
Yeah.
And they have to resolve that story. And evidently, that those were most of those, all those episodes, I think, are done from the third season. But it sounds like they've gone, from what I read, they've gone back into production to finish this, because I guess Seth MacFarlane has time, and so does the rest of the cast. And we're going to see a complete season three by the end of this year, beginning of next year. It's not, but you know, it's moved from Fox, obviously, to Hulu.
Which is another reason why it's going to be one and done.
Correct.
I don't see Hulu.
Well, I mean, Hulu's, how long can you take, even though I will say it has been extremely well done and it's been very entertaining, but how do you take a single book like The Handmaid's Tale and turn it into five seasons when the actual Handmaid's Tale book ended at the end of season one? So that being said, you know, it might make a fourth season. I don't know that it would make a fifth season. But if it makes a fourth season, it will be without Seth MacFarlane.
Which, I know, you've expressed some reservations. I would be okay with it, to be honest.
I would be okay with it being... I'm just saying, I don't think the show has a lot... with what people like about the show, if you have to pivot focus of the show away from Ed Mercer, that's going to be a hard pivot.
So long as the new captain is not a Jellicoe.
Correct.
If they bring in a Jellicoe, that all bets are off.
Yeah, that's going to be tough. Very tough. I don't know.
My understanding of the status of the Orville universe is such that, you know, initially Orville was supposed to be just some, you know, like 493,622 out of, you know, a billion starships in level of importance. And now it's rapidly moved up the list because there's a shortage of ships and a shortage of captains and this, that, and the other thing. My beef with that is that's dramatically going to change the shift of the focus of the show anyway.
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to play games like they did the first two seasons.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Hold on a minute here. Yeah, here it is. Comic Book Magazine talks about the third season. This is where I read all this. Was third season of Orville is officially back in production, and that was in January 3rd. They were on the list of Disney shows that were going to be set back additional time in production because of COVID, because Hollywood was being shut back down in January. It says production paused in March at the back in 2020. I should say. Production team was continuing to figure out how to film during COVID-19. The official Orville Twitter account shared a photo from the show's set. Cameras began rolling again, and we're back. And let's see, this article. Oh, this is actually back in December. And then in January, California shut down. January 2021, California shut down, so they were hit again. But it sounds like they're back in production again. I mean, which I have some hope for the show, since if they're back in production, that means that there is a priority to at least get season three done.
Oh, I have no doubts that they're going to get season three
done. And
there's
another article here about March 10th of 2021 from CinemaBlend that Orville has, after all the shutdowns because of COVID, they're back in production again on season three.
But I think because of all the production delays is kind of what's sealing the coffin.
Correct, correct.
There's no way to really move forward.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping they actually do write a conclusion.
I do too. If they're not going to go forward with it past this, they need to...
Because, quite frankly, Hulu should have already made a decision whether or not they're going to do a season four already, if they were going to.
Yeah.
And the fact that we've not heard anything, I think, is a bad sign.
Yes. Well, there are some things, like Fansided has a thing about their Bordas and Clyden, their marriage is going to end as part of season three.
I'm okay with that.
I am too. I think they're going to revisit the whole forced gender change on the child between. That was another one I read between Bordas and Clyden. So, you know, it's interesting. There is news out here. A lot of it was from 5 weeks ago when they brought production back. So there was a big press release, and there was a lot of things. I'm trying to see which ones are the more interesting. I mean, some of these, 43 weeks ago, a year ago, you know. The most recent is about 4 weeks ago. And that's about the speculation that Bordas and Clyden's marriage will end. But then a week before that is when... well, at the same time, that's when they were announced they went back into production. And about a week before that, they started releasing things about the show. And one of the things was Fansided released the five things that Orville needs in season three. More Dan. Less Clyden.
Yes.
More Alara.
Yes.
And visit new planets that are not hostile. And uh-huh. More two-part episodes like Identity. That's what... I don't know that I'm not a fan of the two-part episode. Yeah. Unless it... I am a fan of the two-part episode only when it's like the season finale and then the season opener for the next season. I like those because there's anticipation there, you know. And it also, it provides continuity because you're having a story that was not resolved and then you get the resolution as the first. So it's kind of a feel-good moment in the beginning of, you know, kind of like the...
Only if there's enough mystery to last the stoppage in production.
Yes, yeah. Well, you know, that was the... I think the quintessential one I can remember from TNG was the Best of Both Worlds, Parts 1 and 2. You know.
Did Picard live?
Correct.
You know,
because... That particularly then, before the internet was like it is today, there were a lot of things that could have happened. Patrick Stewart could have decided, I'm done with Trek, and this is how you're getting me out of it.
Yep.
And, you know, they could have brought in a new captain character. They could have taken Will Riker and made him captain permanently. There's all kinds of things, you know. And I don't know that it would have hurt the show if that had happened.
I would start to propose the concept of Marvel's "What If"?
Yeah.
In the Star Trek universe, let's explore that if we must.
Well, you know the some of these properties, even if they had to recast, like we've always talked. Although I hated Wesley Crusher, I don't hate Will Wheaton. He was not a terrible actor.
See, now I hate Will Wheaton, and I'm tolerant of Wesley Crusher. But that has more to do with his post-TNG life than...
Yeah, I mean, I'm not like Sheldon Cooper. I'm not going to try to be friends with Will Wheaton and, you know, get him to sign my action figure or anything. But I don't think he's a bad actor. And so, you know, there have been the rumors, and then you and I have personally talked about, you know, Will Wheaton becoming a younger Will Riker. Because Jonathan Frakes can't go back and do that. But Will Wheaton looks...
Could.
Enough, yeah, Will Wheaton could. The only difference is they need to dub in a lower voice, you know. Jonathan Frakes' voice has a lot more gravitas than Will Wheaton's voice does. His voice, even though he's our age, is kind of squeaky.
I would wonder if he couldn't take vocal lessons and learn.
He probably could.
How to do that.
And I actually have thought Will Wheaton has done a good job in his role on Paramount Plus doing all of the
Ready Rooms.
I enjoy those, and he does a great job on that. You know, and the other
thing, every now and then he ventures into, okay, I'm annoyed territory. Yeah. But it's not very often.
Well, part of it too is Will Wheaton is actually a geek.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, what show was I watching the other night? Oh, the show Them, which is, that's a totally another discussion, on Amazon Prime. It's, Tuvok is in that show.
Okay.
He's the janitor at the high school in that show. And it's really a very small part, but it was interesting to see Tim Russ. And the reason I say that is Tim Russ was also another Star Trek fan. Because there have been so many people who have become famous because of Star Trek who were not fans of Star Trek.
Right.
You know, one of my absolute favorite characters, you know, was exactly that way. And that's Trip Tucker. You know, the actor who portrayed Trip Tucker had not watched Star Trek before.
Which is bizarre, because Connor Trinneer has done sci-fi like the trifecta.
Oh, I know. He's done Stargate, Star Trek.
I mean, he's been everywhere.
Yeah. Well, he was in two Stargate series. He was in Atlantis as one of the actual named Wraith villains.
Right.
And then he was the professor in the limited series of 15-minute episodes, Stargate Origins.
Yes.
And what was the, besides Enterprise, what else was he in?
I may be wrong about this, but I kind of remember him showing up in BSG somewhere, but I could be wrong about that.
I don't know. Let us consult the internet gods. Go to IMDb, put in Connor Trinneer. And most people don't realize that Connor Trinneer was in Atlantis because of the prosthetics and everything. So, he's been in a lot of science fiction and horror, which is really weird. So, yeah, he was Professor Paul Langford in Stargate Origins. He was Dr. Thomas Adams in the video game ReCore, which is a science fiction video game. He was in NCIS LA for one episode. He's in Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles.
That's probably where I remember him from.
And then he was Michael Kenmore in Stargate Atlantis, and then, which was the Wraith, the named Wraith. He was in 10 episodes of that. He's been in The Family Guy. He's been in NCIS. And then, you know, he was obviously Charles Trip Tucker III in Enterprise for 97 episodes.
Wow, he did The Mentalist.
He was in an episode of Sliders.
24. He was in 24. Wow.
Yeah, he's been in a lot of things.
Criminal Minds? NCIS? Numbers.
Well, I think we've finished talking about First Contact Day. And then we'll actually have to talk about some other geeky but more tech stuff in our next episode. So we want to hear from you. Please send us some feedback to gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. And we'll see you on the digital flip side.
You've been listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's GIZMOSAPIENS. SAPIENS at gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the Digital Flip Side.